Welcome back to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. We're vibing over here. Broadcasting live from the Kintec studio. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at dunbarlumber.com. Got to take some accountability here. A couple of people pointed out, I said this is the first time they've had Hughes, Hronek, Miller, Pettersson, Besser all available. Of course, they all started the season healthy. It was Demko who was with the key top six, or one of the six best players who was missing to start the season. So it is the first time they have all those guys available, but Demko won't be playing tonight. So available, but not on the ice for the first time, all six of those players. Thank you to the people who texted in about that. All right, as mentioned, he covers the NHL for The Athletic, one of our favorites on the show. He is Sean Gentile. What's going on, man?
No, your answer today.
Yes,
congratulations
to you.
Congratulations to the listener. It's a big moment.
Congratulations to you.
Thank you. Yeah, we're all winners.
Congrats all around. We've already won, and the hit has just started. It's fantastic. I do have to carry on a Drance tradition, though, and ask you about your Steelers after another playoff loss.
I mean, let's see. We're like midway through January. That means that the Steelers just got stomped in a divisional playoff game. That sounds about right. Just rinse, repeat. We can have the same conversation next year if you want. You can just pencil me in.
Yeah.
Pencil me in for next for 2026 and saying something similar.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Anyways, I had to bring it up, but I really don't know what I was expecting you to say. It's like, yeah, it happened again.
What are you going to do? Not like not going to be a coaching change. There'll be some other mediocre quarterback at the top of the food chain next year.
And, yeah,
you know, if that's the way it is, then why expect anything different?
So the Canucks in Winnipeg tonight playing the Jets, finishing up a five-game road trip for them. And, you know, looking at Winnipeg, man, they had such an incredible start to the season, right? 15-1 out of the gate. Since then, you know, basically playing at a 90-point pace. And when you look at that, is that, you know, more of a case of like, hey, we've got such a cushion, we can take our foot off the gas a little bit? Do you see cause for concern, or do you still look at this team as a Stanley Cup contender?
I think it's probably 50-50. Like they did, you know, sprint out to a nice little cushion there, and you give them credit for it. But man, even when they were tearing it up at the start, I'm always hesitant to like dump on teams that go 12-2 or 14-2 or whatever, right? Because, you know, wins count. You're banking points, like credit where it's due. But the way they were doing it, you know, back in October and November was making me nervous. It was a lot of power play goals mixed in there, man. And that's fine. Power play goals count too. But, the problem with that was, you know, they weren't generating a ton of chances on the power play. This wasn't some, you know, scoring chance machine, with the extra man. They were capitalizing on their chances, and they were certainly riding a little bit of a shooting percentage wave there. But man, it was so much of their success and so much of their offense was built around, you know, some early heaters on special teams there. And that's always a bad sign. So I look at them, I see, you know, a decent 5-on-5 team, not a great one. And I see a really good goaltender, and you know, that we know, man, we've seen it so many times that can go both ways. You'd like to have a little bit more substance, you know, but behind the way that they've played. But also, I mean, what are you going to do? Like you said, they sprinted out to a pretty serious lead, and I would imagine some degree of, you know, energy saving mode has started there too, to some extent.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think it's probably hard not to at a certain point, right? To have that kind of set in for you when you're that far out in front of the pack. Now, as you pointed out, you know, special teams playing a huge role, and then always with the Winnipeg Jets, a big part of the story is goaltending. And Connor Hellebuck, he's been absolutely phenomenal, obviously. Clearly the Vezina frontrunner, possibly even a Hart Trophy candidate as a goalie this year with how he's playing. I guess also, though, the key thing for the Jets with me is, as I try to figure out, do I really buy them as contenders, is what version of Connor Hellebuck are you going to get in the playoffs? Well, what version are you going to get for, you know, two, three, four rounds in the Stanley Cup playoffs? If it's this version of Connor Hellebuck that we've seen so far, then they're going to be an extraordinarily tough out, and they are Stanley Cup contenders. But if it's the version we've seen the last couple of playoffs, and maybe, you know, rest plays a role there, or lack of rest plays a role, then I'm not buying it, because as you said, they're so reliant on goaltending. It really, so much of it does come down for me to Connor Hellebuck.
Yeah, man, it's two straight postseason trips we've seen where, whether it's running out of gas or just, you know, an accumulation of just having to do so much over the course of the regular season. Like, blame what you want for it, right? But he's been mediocre, putting it kindly, if you want to describe the way he's played in the last couple of playoffs. Like, I watched that dude get out-dueled by Alexander Georgiev a couple times in that Avs-Jets series last season, and that's not good. They need him to be their best player. And, you know, if that means, and maybe that's where, you know, being able to bank so many points early on helps a little bit. I don't mean to like flag on the Central Division because it's good. And there's, you know, a couple elite teams in there certainly, but maybe if, you know, they can keep him fresher down the stretch and kind of ensure that they don't have a repeat of what we've seen the last couple of years. That's the single biggest thing. Cause we know they're not going to score a ton of goals. You can't rely on that. You know, you look at their lineup, it relies on a lot of guys like Cole Perfetti, who, you know, had a great October, but has done basically nothing since then, and on and on. So they need Hellebuck to be good. And if that means, you know, taking some hits down the course of the regular season and maybe starting him a little bit less than they have in the past, I think that's probably a wise move.
Where do you land on Connor Hellebuck in the Hart Trophy conversation?
It's so tough because I feel like if we start giving it, like,
then it's a goalie every year, right? Yeah, that's part of it.
A goalie should win it every year.
Yeah.
Goalies, by definition, are just more valuable than skaters. That's just kind of the way it goes. So I'm of two minds there. Like, I think to some degree they are underrepresented, but also, like, and I hate the term slippery slope. I think that's used in bad faith a lot of times, but it kind of is. Like, if we give it to Connor Hellebuck this year for providing the most value, we got to be prepared to start doing it more often. And I think there could be some, you know, unforeseen consequences if he gets the award. But at the same time, man, what player in the league means more to his team individually than Connor Hellebuck? I'm not sure there's anybody.
Sticking in the Western Conference, the Canucks find themselves kind of unexpectedly in a dogfight for a playoff spot with the Calgary Flames. I don't want to write off completely, you know, Utah and St. Louis in the chasing pack in the Western Conference, but right now the Flames are a point ahead of the Canucks with the same number of games played. They beat Chicago yesterday. I think that's now three wins in a row for Calgary, and it feels like we've all just been kind of waiting for them to fall off a cliff, to fall out, you know, go back down towards a bottom five or bottom six or seven type team, like a lot of us expected them to be coming into the year. Are you buying that they have staying power for the second half of the season?
I didn't buy that they had staying power for the first half of the season. So, like, what do I know? Like, I've been waiting for them to fall off, you know, for about 2 months now to 10 weeks. Like, I don't entirely know how they're doing what they're doing either. Like, credit to them for it. But yeah, it's been strange. Like, I mean, I'm sure you guys didn't think you'd be scoreboard watching in mid January, right? Like, it's St. Louis versus Calgary tonight, and that's a crucial one for the Canucks already. It's a bizarre world we're living in.
Yeah, gotta pray for the 2-point game, the regulation game in that one. Yeah, I mean, didn't expect to be scoreboard watching, and certainly not with the Flames. Like, that's the craziest part, to be, as I said, in that dogfight with them, considering what the expectations were for them coming into the season. And, you know, I do wonder, like, Dustin Wolfe has been so good for them, and I get it. He's been incredible everywhere in his career, but it's still a young goalie. Like, how long can that last, I wonder? And if they're not getting the saves at quite that rate, I think it could look a lot different in Calgary.
Yeah, and he's, you know, I hate bringing this up about Dustin Wolfe because it's like, it's followed him throughout his entire career. Not a big dude. It's his first full NHL season. Like, you wonder what the workload's going to look like for him down the stretch. I know it sounds like Dan Vladar is starting tonight. He's been terrible. So, like, if they have to keep riding Dustin Wolfe as the primary driver for all of this, man, I that's not a great situation to be in.
Yeah.
Because for his as good as he is, if that guy, you know, given his frame and given his workload over the last few years, like, I don't know, do you want him to start 55 games like in his first full NHL season? I don't think so. But that's also kind of paradoxically their best chance to keep it going. It's not a great spot to be in, but also, and then they're playing relevant games in January, and that's not something I expected from them either. So what do I know?
Wow, I've heard meaningful games in March before. I've never heard relevant games in January. We're lowering the bar even farther.
Dude, when you're talking about the Flyers should be one of the three worst teams in the league. Like I looked at that roster back when we're doing preseason stuff. I'm like, what is, like, who's supposed to be good here? Like I know Huberdeau was good on the power play at the back half of last year, but other than that, you're like, is Connor Zary going to take a jump? Whatever. And now here we are, man. I got to give him credit. They've stuck it to a lot of people, and I think I'm included in that group for sure.
One team that has not stuck it to a lot of people, the team Calgary beat last night, the Chicago Blackhawks, last in the NHL standings. And, you know, Connor Bedard, like, he's gotten on a personal heater, started to rack up some points, but the team just keeps losing. And it feels like every time Connor Bedard pops up on my timeline now, he just sounds so incredibly dejected and down. And I guess on the one hand, you look at it and say, like, hey, great, this guy we drafted first overall, he's in his second year, he hates losing, that's the kind of culture we want, that's the mentality we want. But you also, I think, have to worry about the toll it's taking on, you know, the guy who's kind of supposed to be your franchise savior. How dire is the situation, not just right now for Chicago, but how much risk is there going forward in this rebuilding process for them as well?
I think that was always a concern, man. They just stripped it so bare. Even when you look back to, you know, non-tendering Strom the year that they were, the Bedard year, like the year that they were openly, obviously, like, trying to tank, on and on. There's just like a list of moves that they made over the course of that process where you're like, be careful what you wish for here, man. Be careful what you ask for. We've seen it backfire, you know, plenty of times. I think Bedard's good enough to kind of safeguard against that. And, you know, also Frank Nazar, I don't know. We'll see. Like, there's some pieces that seem like they're on the verge of arriving, but then you look at that lineup and you're just like, who, again, like, it kind of, it's similar to what I said about the Flames. You're like, where, you know, I think people put the cart in front of the horse with the Blackhawks this year because they assembled what looked like a functional NHL roster, right? Like at least mm-hmm. relative to where they were the last couple years. And I think people looked at that and extrapolated a little bit too far and mistook, you know, an actual NHL roster for like a quasi-competitive NHL roster. Those are two separate things. And I think the way they're playing night in, night out is kind of proof of that. Because, you know, past Bedard and past some of the young pieces, and I like Tyler Bertuzzi's been better. Like, other than that, I'm not sure where the improvement is even supposed to come from, honestly.
We're talking to Sean Gentile from The Athletic here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. And, you know, we're starting to inch closer to the trade deadline coming up in early March, you know, less than 2 months away now. And it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out, because there's the break for the Four Nations, and I think trades are still allowed to happen in that period, but it would be a little bit surprising to see a lot of activity in that downtime for the league. So, you know, not that much time on the calendar left for teams to kind of wheel and deal before the trade deadline. And I find it fascinating looking at the Eastern Conference specifically. Almost the whole conference is still in that playoff race, right? Or at least could talk themselves into being in that playoff race. And, you know, even in the Western Conference, there's more teams that are clearly out of it. But it feels like we could be in a real kind of dearth of sellers at the trade deadline this year. How are you kind of anticipating the market setting up ahead of the deadline?
Yeah, you know, I've thought for a while now that it would be two quasi-deadlines. Like kind of a soft deadline before, because the Four Nations tournament starts on Feb 12. Like you think maybe you'd see, you know, some moves in anticipation of that. But man, you said it. Like, who are the sellers? I mean, like just look at the Eastern Conference. You know, like, just when you think there's a team you can write off, like we'll use Detroit as the example. Yeah. You know, a few weeks ago it seems like they're cooked. They fire their coach. You know, whatever. And now they've won seven straight games and they're right there in the thick of it. I mean, that's what happens when you have a bunch of mediocre teams. Like they're all similarly flawed, similarly mediocre. So you have, you know, one or two teams on a roll at any given time, and over the course of a full season, that means that, you know, the winner of the second wild card is on pace to put up, you know, 86 points or whatever it is. It's crazy. But there's not a lot of good teams out there, and a lot of it stems back from the Rangers collapsing. I know we talked about that plenty, but
yeah.
with them out of the picture, that opened up that spot, and there was no team who was a ready-made fit to kind of pop back in. So we're talking about 5, 6, 7 teams in the mix. I mean, it's crazy, and it's going to have an impact, you know, not just on the Feb 12 start of the Four Nations as far as trade's concerned, but I think in on the March 7th one as well.
Yeah, because the other thing is you look at the handful of teams that are clear sellers. You know, we were talking Chicago, San Jose still in that mix.
Mm-hmm.
It's not as if they're flush with these impact UFAs they're looking to
right.
do. You know, it's like, okay, Taylor Hall, okay, I'll take a flyer on him. But if you're looking to really punch up your top six or your top four on the blue line, the selling teams they're not helping you in that regard.
Totally. Like, what are you going to do? Is there going to be a stampede for, you know, Michael Granlund or
yeah.
whatever, like something
yeah.
like
or Cody CC or yeah,
yeah. I mean, good luck and good luck selling guys like that as impact pieces. If you're an actual contender, you know, a high end top tier contender that's looking to add, because there's a lot of half decent players and a lot of complimentary players. But man, those teams at the bottom are at the bottom for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
It's because they got a lot of guys that can't help all that much, for sure.
Yeah, it doesn't look like there's a Jake Guentzel equivalent going to be yeah. on this year's market. Although, I mean, it's not an equivalent situation, but a couple of high-profile names have certainly been floated here in Vancouver as potentially on the move in Elias Pettersson and JT Miller. And it seems like it's quieting down a little bit now. I know Darren Dreger had a report today that, you know, not a lot new on that front. Elliot Friedman kind of saying the team thinks the worst is behind them and they can move forward now. So I feel like we're off imminent crazy trade watch here for the Vancouver Canucks. But, you know, from a distance, what were your thoughts watching this whole bizarre story unfold over the last few weeks?
When it hit the next level for me, when Elliot said effectively, like, don't rule out them trading both
yeah.
last week. I'm like, hold on a second. What are we talking about here? Like, I can get trading one of them. Certainly, it just seems like they don't mesh in a lot of different ways. And like, we don't need to go any further into that. I'm mm-hmm. sure you guys you're tired of talking about that. But like, fine, trade one of them. Figure something out if that's what needs to happen. But trading both, man, that's just like cutting off your nose to spite your face. Because this is a team like they should be in the business of winning playoff series like right now. And if you move those two guys in season, I don't care how good the return is or how good it looks a year or two or three down the line, you're making yourself so demonstrably worse in the present that it seems like it shouldn't be that much of a consideration. So, yeah, I mean, as someone who, you know, business is good when high profile guys are getting moved. So on some level, that's a disappointment. But man, just as someone who wants to see, you know, good teams do great things, I'm honestly sort of relieved that that stuff's quieted down, because that was just next level craziness last week when for a split second there, it seemed like both of them were going to get moved.
Yeah, it was a weird time. It was a very, very weird time. Sean, always appreciate it, man. Thank you for doing this. We'll chat soon.
All right, brother. We'll talk to you soon.
That is Sean Gentile from The Athletic covering the NHL, weighing in on the Jets, the Canucks, some of the other things happening around the league as well. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Landon Farrar is going to join me in studio at 1 o'clock for the final hour of the show. We'll get his thoughts on tonight's matchup between the Canucks and the Jets. Time for a few minutes here, though, to dive in to the Dunbar Lumber text line. I was speaking earlier about the challenge for the Canucks beating Connor Hellebuyck tonight. Daniel and Burnaby text in, getting him moving east-west is the way to beat Hellebuyck. Traffic and good east-west movement with quality shots. I agree. generating those east-west passes and those east-west scoring chances has been a real struggle for the Canucks. And, you know, traffic, that's a big part of their game plan, but it tends to be traffic with shots from the point, looking for those deflections, looking for those rebounds, those greasy goals. Hey, it worked in Toronto. There's been a lot of games this year where it hasn't worked. That's a tough game plan to beat Connor Hellebuyck. So I agree. I would love to see more of those east-west passing plays to get him moving laterally and open up those high-quality scoring chances. That hasn't exactly been the Canucks' bread and butter for the last couple of seasons. I think it's asking a lot for them to go out and win the game with those types of plays tonight in Winnipeg. But you never know. It's not as if they don't have players who are capable of doing it. Quinn Hughes can do it. Elias Pettersson can do it. JT Miller can do it. They have playmakers who can facilitate those types of chances. Can the team environment put those players in a position to do so tonight in Winnipeg? Again, 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. This is a good text, unsigned. What does a good Pettersson follow-up game look like to you if he quietly shuts down the Scheifele line at 5-on-5? Is that good enough? If he shuts down that line, right, on the heels of shutting down the Matthews line, that's really impressive. That's good. Having said that, and look, if the Canucks win in that scenario, and you know they win a 2-1 game or something like that, Pettersson's not on the score sheet, but he keeps Scheifele and Connor off the score sheet as well, wins territorially, wins his matchup at 5-on-5, the Canucks win. Yeah, it's going to be very hard to complain about that performance from Pettersson. But, and I said this yesterday on the show, talking about his defensive performance in Toronto, I don't want to take anything away from what he's capable of doing in his own end. That's really important. It matters a lot to have a number one center who's capable of taking care of business in his own end like that at a very high level. It's also not sufficient. There has to be the offensive bottom line, and not just production with Pettersson, but game-breaking moments too. So, look, if they're getting results, if they're winning, and he's helping contribute to that with his defensive game and the points aren't there, yes, of course you can live with that temporarily. But at some point, they're going to need him to be not just producing, not just picking up, you know, power play assists, secondary points here or there, things like that. They need him to be an offensive driver, to be an offensive driver and an offensive game breaker. Now, you certainly don't want to see him go backwards. So maybe, look, if he just holds at the level he was at against Toronto defensively and the points don't come, is that a success if they win? Yeah, I would say that's probably a success. But how long can that qualify as a success for Pettersson before you really start to see or need to start to see the points and the dynamic offensive ability back and the flair back as well for him? 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Tommy texts in, if the Canucks lose the next five games, could they be sellers at the deadline? Well, I don't know about the next five games. And look, at that point, yeah, you'd be getting close to the Four Nations break, but you'd still have more than a month to go before the deadline. So still lots of room for things to play out. I guess I don't know exactly what being sellers would look like for the Canucks either. You know, I know people's first thought will go to Brock Besser, but if you want to sign, like, let's say even if they did decide to sell this year's deadline, that doesn't mean you're punting on next year. It doesn't mean you're all of a sudden rebuilding. So even Brock Besser, if something catastrophic happened in the next month and the Canucks did drop out of the playoff race and management said, look, you know what? It's not our year. We've got to sell. That doesn't necessarily mean you don't want Brock Besser on your team next year. You could still want him back. You could still want to do a long-term extension with Brock Besser. And you look at their other UFAs, you've got Pugh Suter. Well, that might be an interesting candidate if you were really out of it to try to move. I could see teams being interested in a guy who's that versatile for you, was playing big minutes in the playoffs for them last year. Obviously, Kevin Lankinen, but I mean, goalies, non-established goalies at the deadline, how much are you really going to get in that move? And then, you know, you're down to guys like Derek Forbort, Noah Juulsen, depth defensive options. So even in that situation, you know, selling, it's not going to be an extreme sell-off for the Canucks, even if they found themselves in a pretty dire position in the standings by the time the deadline rolled around. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. You can send your thoughts in. As I mentioned, Landon Farrar is going to join me in studio next. So if you got questions for Landon about the Canucks, hit us up, 650-650 to the Dunbar Lumber text line. That's next here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd here. We are broadcasting live from the Kintec studio. Kintec Footwear and Orthotics working together with you in step 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. It's a Canucks game day. Taking on the Winnipeg Jets at 5 o'clock tonight. Of course, you can hear the call with Batch and Randeep here on Sportsnet 650. And you can send your questions in 650, 650 to the Dunbar Lumber text line. As mentioned, joining me now in studio for the final hour of the show. And he's going to be back on Thursday this week, too. Looking forward to it. He is former NHL player, Canucks analyst here on 650 and Sportsnet TV, Landon Ferraro. What's going on, man?
Not a whole lot. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. I'm luxuriating and not having Drance around. Relaxing, stretching out, spreading my wings in the studio, taking up space. It's great. And I get to talk to you, which is lovely, instead of Drance. So I in the break, I lied to you and I said we were going to start with Elias Pettersson. But then I was like, wait, no, Philip Ronick's coming back. We have to start there. So we're going to start there instead. I'm throwing you a curveball. Getting Philip Ronick, like, obviously, you get your second best defenseman back. That's a big deal. But specifically, even tonight, where, you know, you expect him to be getting back to speed and finding his legs and shaking off some rust. But I mean, what's the kind of immediate impact of having him back in the lineup to you?
I mean, it's another guy that's, you're sitting there, he's plus 14 on the year. Like, and the plus minus is what it is. But you also don't get to a higher number or an extremely low number by being unlucky or super lucky. Like, but you look at the rest of the D, and beside Quinn Hughes, everyone's in the minuses. And so, like, it adds another player that, whether he plays with Quinn for the most part or they split him up and put, you know, maybe him with Susie and see if he can help kind of get Susie back on the right path while eating some more minutes and giving, you know, bringing another puck moving defenseman into the lineup that you can really trust to, you know, take some minutes back from Quinn Hughes and keep him a little lighter, a little more energetic on each shift. Because I mean, you can see even when Quinn has to play so many minutes, when he gets that little extra rest and he gets a puck, like, man, he can just jump around the offensive zone. So try and open up a little bit of that for sure.
Well, and what do you think about, you know, the idea of potentially splitting Hughes and Hronik up? I was talking about it earlier in the show, and I get, if you have a pairing that you know can be elite, right, one of the best in the NHL, I understand why it's hard to go away from that. And obviously Hughes loves playing with Hronik. You know, he talked about it yesterday. They're desperate to get him back. I get all that. I also just think, you know, like, Quinn Hughes looks pretty good with Tyler Myers too. Quinn Hughes is going to look pretty good no matter who he's out there with. So I wonder if there's not a way to find, like, you got to find a time at some point, I think, to, as you said, you know, Hronik, Susie, let's see what that looks like, to try some other things out here.
Yeah, honestly, like, I watch a lot of Oilers games for some other stuff that I do, and like, I think you treat them just like you treat McDavid and Draisaitl. Like, they are on separate lines, and then for end of periods or, you know, bigger plays, or when you need to claw back into a game, then you reignite them or reunite them and let them go back to work together. But I think you try and keep them as part as well or as much as you possibly can. But whether it's you start the game and you go a period and a quarter and then all of a sudden you need some extra help and they take over for the rest of the game that way, like, that's fine. Like, but just watching how the Oilers can kind of move those two in and out, and it completely changes their forward lineups. Like, it can be the same here. Like, it has, those two have just as big of an impact, obviously in different ways, but like, just maximize the two of them as much as you can. And that's being apart and together, just reading the game situation.
That's a really interesting comparison. And I think it makes a lot of sense because, you know, if you split up Hughes and Hronik to start a game, it's not like it's a permanent divorce. You can always put them back together.
It can literally be for one shift. And like, exactly. And that's happened for Draisaitl and McDavid. Like, they start separate and they have, you know, they go through one rotation of the forward lines and like, okay, this isn't, like, we don't have our legs yet.
Yeah.
So they instantly put them together with Hyman, and then they go set the tone for a couple shifts, and then you split them back up. Like, the guys are good enough to be able to put them into that blender a little bit. As long as they know that's part of the plan going in, then it's not a surprise and it's not something that you have to kind of work out on the go.
Now, I guess on the other side of things, right, when Quinn Hughes, who's playing as well as he is, you know, your best player, your captain, he's done such a good job, and in every facet of his responsibilities this year for you. I guess when he's saying, like, yeah, but I love playing with this guy, it can be pretty hard to go against that if you're a coach.
For sure it would be, but without knowing Quinn Hughes well,
yeah,
the guy wants to win.
Sure.
And if you lay it out for him, again, that's why you have the conversation with them beforehand, but you lay it out this way and show, like, this is why I think this could work. Like, you know, we start with you guys separate. Well, now we're eating three quarters of the game just between your two pairings. But if we need an extra jump or it gets down to, you know, the last minute or two of a period, like, yeah, we'll just throw you guys back. Mm-hmm. And like, now you can be excited and put everything into a couple shifts and then you go back and eat minutes separately. Like, you explain that all to him. Like, he's going to see the benefit. And at worst, I feel like you come out of that conversation with an understanding of, like, we're gonna try this, and if you come to me after a couple games and you really don't like how this is going, we'll have another conversation, and that's fine too.
It's interesting because, you know, they talked in the offseason even, like, hey, that's something we'd like to try. We think Kronik has more capability to carry his own pairing, kind of, or be with a guy like Carson Soucy. We obviously know Quinn Hughes can do it. I think it's one of those things, and we used to see this a lot with, you know, Thatcher Demko and his usage, where you might have a really noble goal of, you know, we're really going to limit Thatcher Demko's usage, but then it's January and you're fighting for a playoff spot and it's like, let's get him back in here for another one. And I wonder how much of the fact that, you know, all of a sudden they wake up today and they're outside of the second wild card spot in the Western Conference. I can imagine as a coach, it would be very difficult to go out of your comfort zone in those circumstances, right? It's like, no, we need 2 points tonight, and Hughes Hronik might give us the best chance at that.
Yeah, and like I do agree, but at the same time, like, and you just said it in the last bit of, like, it's not set in stone.
Yeah.
So it's not, but
you're,
like,
not throwing it out forever. Yeah,
yeah. Like, but I look at the situation right now of, okay, we're, what are we, 1 point out of a wild card mm-hmm. spot, and we've had a lot of on ice, off ice things going around. Like, honestly, like, this almost seems like the time to try something else. Like, there's already been so much to go through. Like, the guys are already kind of in that battle mode of just next man up and just deal with what's coming. Like, you know, with the travel and stuff the other night, like, you know, Talkett had mentioned, and I believe him, of, like, you know, honestly, like, it just wasn't even a discussion yeah. for us. Like, we've been through so much this year that honestly is nothing for us right now. So, like, almost use that mentality to try some things. And again, if it doesn't work, and I would imagine they're going to tell within a few shifts if this is going to be something that they're comfortable with or not. And then you just change it back and you move along. Like, it's no worse for the wear, really.
So I think Rick Tocchet, even, he was speaking with Ian McIntyre earlier this week, and he said, you know, we've had so much adversity through this first half. And he wasn't even just talking about, you know, the travel against Toronto, but just in general, you look at everything that's happened to the team through the first half. And he said, you know, I hope we can use that. I hope it makes us better in the second half of this season. Is that a real possibility for you, that just like the emotional relief almost of, hey, we've have Hronik back, we're kind of out of the woods, maybe that was rock bottom, but we're through the worst of it, and now it's going to be a lot easier for us because of what we learned and what we've been through?
For sure. Like, and obviously at the end of the day, like, with everyone back, and you know, you give Hronik a bit of time to get up to speed and yeah. everything as well, but like, you need guys to start performing. Like, at the end of the day, like, you need everyone performing. And that's, at the end of the day, that's all that really matters. But for your question, like, I really do think it is something that you can use as you go forward. Because think of, like, the wildest scenarios of what can happen going down the back mm-hmm. half of the year here. Is anything bigger than what they've already been through? So, like, anything that pops up, it's just, like, it's just another thing, and we're like, all right, well, let's work through that together as well. Like, we've done it 7 other times this year. Like, we can do it again.
Yep.
So it just, like, it lightens everything else out. And when you get to playoff time, or, you know, in that stretch, like, say they're battling with Calgary right down to the end, and where Calgary might be feeling a bit more pressure, like, the Canucks are sitting there knowing that they've been in the playoff, like, they've been to this spot before. But not only that, like, they've put up with so much junk this year, and they were still able to stick together and be in that position. Like, it'll be an easier out for them because again, like they've been through it. They've gone through and
yeah.
And so I mean I think it's something that they'll be able to just kind of use, and it just minimizes anything that can pop up in the future.
So as you said also, you know, at a certain point, like your top guys have to start performing. That's going to be more than anything else, that's what's going to dictate what the Canucks season looks like for the second half. Obviously, Quinn Hughes has been phenomenal all year long. You've seen glimpses, I think it's fair to say, for Miller and Pettersson. But, you know, Pettersson in that game against Toronto rightfully earns a ton of praise for his defensive performance. You know, you heard after the game, they're yelling Selke on the bench and all of that. Is that the type of performance for Pettersson that for him, not just that he can use as a springboard to play more great defensive games, but can the success in his own end also help jumpstart the offensive side of things for him?
For sure. And like, honestly, I think for most like two-way forwards, you know, not just straight stars that are just scorers, like everything does start from the defensive end. It's because you have to be so much more aware in your own end. You have to be able to make those little plays in tight to not just throw the puck out. Like for him, doing what he does, like he needs to be so sharp in his defensive end, and especially mentally. Like a couple of the pickups and like defensive player pickups that he had last game, a couple of the blocks, like you can't just happen to be in the right spot for those. Like you have to be dialed in, but you also have to be willing to do it. And as you get that buy-in from yourself, as you get into the offensive zone, like that's where the fun is. So now you're like in your head, you're not even like, it's just kind of processed for you in the back of your mind of like, okay, I've done the work down here. Like that's for the team. Now this is for me up here. Right. But like, is it like, and I don't mean that in a selfish way. Like that's what hockey is. Like everyone wants to score, whether you're six or 36, like scoring a goal is fun. Like that is the reason you play. Like I enjoyed the penalty kill, but I wasn't playing to be a PK guy. I wanted to eventually put the puck in and get a hug from a buddy once in a while.
And the thing with Pettersson too is it's not like the skill sets, the defensive one and the offensive one, it's not like they don't overlap, right? As you're saying, like he has to be so mentally dialed in on the defensive side of things to play at that level. And that's always been one of, if not his greatest skills as a player offensively as well, his ability to read the game, his hockey IQ. And I almost wonder if it could serve as like a bit of a reminder for him, you know, internally, like, oh, right, I'm really smart. I can read the game. I can make these plays. I can apply that down there, too.
And the one thing you didn't mention there that he is so good at is like being like on puck battles and like board battles. Like he's so strong on his stick and he uses his body extremely well for a guy that's not really thick. Like he's lankier, but he's got longer limbs, but like he's able to use that. And especially on the D side, like you use that for boxing out. You use it for when there's a bobbled puck, like you can get through the guy's hands quick. And now you're on the right side of the puck. And like, honestly, it's the same exact game that he plays in the offensive zone. Like for him, it's all about trying with the puck is trying to find the space. And on the flip side, it's him taking it away. It's doing the same thing, just the other side of the coin. So like it all intertwines into itself, but you're right. Like when you're producing and playing well in your defensive end, there's nothing you can do that doesn't make that translate over because offense, it's all about just being committed, really. Like you have to be committed to what your skill set is, but it's getting into the hard areas, getting into getting pucks to the net. Like it's all that stuff. It's the exact same in a sense as the defensive zone.
And with Pettersson as well, part of the story of that game in Toronto on Saturday was, you know, it's not just that he's playing great defensively. He's taken on a lot of the matchup minutes against Austin Matthews and Mitch Marner and some of the elite offensive players in the game. And I wonder how much, you know, for Pettersson specifically, being tasked with that responsibility is a big deal for him, you know, because I think there are some players, right, where they absolutely want that. Even if it means they have to work harder in the defensive end, there's something about going head to head with the best guy on the other team that brings the best out of those players.
Yeah. And what I'm about to say, like, I don't mean it as a knock, and there's a lot of guys in the league like this, and I don't think there's anything wrong with it. But it's like, to your point, some guys need that matchup to be able to play their best. Like when they think the night's going to be easier, like they see it and, not that they have it completely written down on the board, but okay, JT's taking the top matchup tonight. No, okay, now I have the easier matchup. I'm going to have some points tonight. Well, all of a sudden, that's kind of the PD that you see on the outside trying to find those plays and being a little more perimeter. But when he gets those bigger matchups, he is so good defensively, but you're right, like it brings out the best in him because he knows, like, I have to be ready at puck drop to play against this line, because even if I mess up one time in this game and it pops onto Matthews' tape or it ends up on Marner's tape, who's going to find Matthews next, like it's going to be in the back of my net. And like some guys need that risk and they need that type of level to get the best out of themselves. And you saw it with Pettersson the other night. Like even as much as his assist is a bank off the boards, like that's him reading that I can be lower. Like I feel like before you would have seen him in the high slot, like really being defensive, but he read there's three guys down there. If I'm just off the side of the net, like I'm still on the defensive side of my guy. Like it's fine. I can be here. But like, again, that's a hockey read. And then it's quick up top and they get some shots. Like it's a type of assist that, again, like you need to be thinking and you need to be aware of where guys are. And again, like he was dialed in and he knew that he could be down there.
Yeah, I think back to, and this is going a few years back now, but one of the things that came out when they made the switch from Travis Green to Bruce Boudreau, you know, Pettersson and Hughes weren't killing penalties at that time. And there was a story that they went to Boudreau and were like, hey, we want to be a part of this. The penalty kill is a big issue. We can help put us on the penalty kill. And, you know, Pettersson's been part of it. Not the biggest part necessarily, but he's been a regular part since then. And I think it just speaks to that, you know, he has a desire. He obviously takes a lot of pride in his ability to be more of an offensive player. And I think it makes a lot of sense to lean into that, feed that part of him, right? If that's something that's going to be a catalyst for him, get him out there on the PK, get him out in those matchup minutes. I mean, he's got another really good line tonight to go up against in Shifley, Connor, and Velarde. Look, and people will text in, you know, like, why do you have to cater to Pettersson? He's making so much money. I get that, but at a certain point, if you're the coach, you know, your job is to get the most out of your players. And if this is the position you need to put him in to get the most out of him, then I think that's what you got to do and let the rest of the roster figure it out a little bit.
Yeah, and I think the other part with it is with Pettersson, like, yes, like you need him to produce, you need him to get points, but if you get it to the point where, okay, he's playing offensively, but when he has his droughts, like you've got him to the point and he is there. It's not like Tockett needs to work with him to get him here. It's just about, you know, putting him in those spots. But like then his drought becomes, okay, yeah, he might not score for a few games, but he's still completely shutting down the top line.
Yes.
Like that is still finding value in your big ticket player.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter if he's making what he is, like he's going to have off games. He's going to have times where the puck literally just doesn't go in. And what can he do? And if you just turn into a guy that can play some minutes and, you know, help out a little bit, okay, great. But that's kind of fourth line, not like when things aren't going great. Like to shut down, to be able to play him against the best line of the other team and know, like, okay, like he's going to be committed to this and he enjoys it and he's going to do a good job. Like that's a pretty good kind of down few games.
Well, yeah, somebody texted in, you know, what would count as a good follow-up to the Toronto performance for you from Elias Pettersson specifically? And the texter said the used the example of, you know, if he quietly shuts down Shifley and Connor at 5-on-5, is that a good performance? And yeah, if the team wins, then yeah, probably is, right? Like that's a big part of his job. And I think there has to be a higher level eventually. But as you said, if that's the low ebb where, okay, hey, you're not getting the points right now, the puck's not going in for you, but you're going out there and putting in that defensive shift every night against elite players, it's hard to complain about that too much.
I would like to see some one-timers in that stretch too, like on the power play. Like, but see, like that's what I think it can and should get to is like, we can't minimize, you know, at the end of the day, that last game, like he had one assist and it looks like not much, but that is a early goal in a massive game. Like that's a lot bigger assist than it looks like on paper.
Yeah.
And, but you know, for tonight, like say it isn't goals and it's more of the same, like, yeah, like him shutting down that line, but being a little more direct and lethal on the power play, because that's where he should be able to, on those down nights, he should be able to find some offense, some courage, like some confidence in it, is the power play.
Yes.
Like, you need to start seeing that shot.
And you think that, I would think that's where, if he is finding more confidence, right, that's where it should really come out in the power play, because there's been so many times where he's looked tentative, and it's not just not getting off the one-timer for me. It's also, you know, the puck comes to him, and instead of crisply making the next play, it's hold, 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 dust it off, okay, back to Quinn Hughes. And yeah, he's just capable of so much more than that. If his confidence is going up a notch, you're right, it should translate pretty directly to the power play too.
Yeah, like right now, it's almost, it's, I mean, it's pretty predictable in the sense of, like, that puck comes to him on the half wall, and as soon as it touches his tape, it's like an instant back pedal,
yes,
2 feet. And really all that's doing is giving the PK guys another 3 seconds, which doesn't seem like much, but that is an eternity to look around, completely get your bearings again, lock up your lanes, and make sure that everything's tied down good. So, like, exactly to what you said, like, and I, you know, we've talked about this before, but like, I would love to see, and he did it the one game, I can't remember who they're playing against now, but there was, like, he took, like, off those passes, like, his first step was in. Like, it's, he's at the top of the circle. Mm-hmm. Like, his first step needs to be straight east-west. And now he's pulled himself in. That'll open up whoever's down on the goal line, whoever's rotating through there. So he has an out there. He can lay it off to Quinn back up top. He can shoot. Like, within, by taking 2 steps off puck touch, like, you now have 3 options. Instead of you stand there and you have 2, you can either go down or up, but the guys are already in position. So you're going to move it down, and he's going to one touch it back to you.
Right.
Now we're in the same position. So now all we've done is killed 7 more seconds. So it's just like, you need to be a bit more assertive on that half wall. And there's no reason he shouldn't be. Like, he has the skill to do it.
That's the thing. He should be. And it, one of the fascinating things for me, even over the last, you know, 4 or 5 seasons, when the Canucks have had a really good power play for the whole season, or certainly parts of a season in there, it's, Patterson's never really been that big a part of it. You know, like, you think of, like, the way they've scored a lot, it's the Bo Horvat play while he was here, JT Miller coming down his downhill side and picking a corner, and there was a stretch early in his career where the one-timer was a weapon, but I've always wanted to see Patterson take on more of a playmaking role on the power play, rather than just using him as a decoy or trying to set up that one-timer. Get the puck on his stick, as you said, get him attacking, and let him make some plays for guys, because you would think he should be, that's the kind of thing that he could be a lead at, given his skill set.
Yeah, like, at the end of the day, they're just, like, there needs to be more movement in the Canucks power play. And, like, a good example of that is Detroit. Detroit with Lalonde, their power play was not very good.
Mm-hmm.
And that's being pretty nice. And as soon as they got the new coach, McClellan comes in, like, just watch the setup and from before and after. Like, the amount of movement on that power play now, and that's now DeBrincat getting one-timers, he's getting open up. Kane is finding ways to make plays. Larkin is in the middle and actually touching the puck now. Like, but it's amazing what just movement does, mm-hmm, on a power play, and every player knows that. And yet, every single player at some point, when things aren't kind of clicking on a power play, you start sitting back a little more. Like, without knowing it, your brain just tries to slow down because you're trying to find the play instead of just making the play.
And I remember Patrick Kane, you know, in his heyday, even late in his Chicago years, he was so good at having the puck on the half wall, and he was never standing still, right?
Never.
He was moving up, down, and it didn't look like he was moving into a dangerous area necessarily with the puck, but the defense has to adjust, right? And then he moves back a little bit, and all of a sudden their passing lane opens. Like, he was always so active with his feet, looking for those passing lanes. And yeah, that stands out as something that the Canucks could incorporate for sure.
And honestly, like, what Kane's looking at there, he's not even looking at that first forward that's playing him. Like, every time he's moving up and down, out of the corner of his eye, he's watching the far penalty killer forward, because he's the one in the middle that's the safety valve for the backdoor pass, for the bumper. Like, he's got a bunch of responsibilities in the middle, and Kane is just toying with that guy without him even knowing it. Because eventually that forward, or that D, is going to pop down the backside, and if he doesn't see it, that's going to open up. And so that pass is made. But if he sees it, now he's going to pull him down another step and a half. Well, now Larkin pops up, and now he's got a bumper one-timer. Like, it's just guys that can see what's going to happen next. And, you know, Patty Kane is a, you know, he is what he is.
I mean, he's an old, yeah.
But at the same time, like, we've all seen Pettersson possess some of that same qualities.
Yep.
Like, he is so elite at finding passing lanes, but there needs to be movement with it.
Yeah, no doubt about it. All right, we'll take a break here. We got another segment with Landon Ferraro in studio coming up. We'll look ahead a little bit specifically to the Jets. I want to talk just also about where this Canucks team goes in the second half now that they do have their key skaters all healthy and available again, and Thatcher Demko for that matter, although Kevin Lankinen will be in goal tonight against Winnipeg. So lots to get into. You can send your thoughts in as well, 650-650 to the Dunbar Lumber text line. It is Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650, final segment of the show today. Jamie Dodd here, Landon Ferraro joining me in studio. We are broadcasting live from the Kintec studio, 650-650. That's the Dunbar Lumber text line, Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at DunbarLumber.com. So we can talk a little bit about the matchup with the Jets specifically, but one thing that's really fascinating to me from this point on for the Canucks now, right? With you've survived absences to Besser, Miller, brief one for Hughes, Pettersson, Hronek coming back after a long absence. And there's been a lot of times over the last, you know, month or so, and definitely since Christmas, where the team's effort has been really high. The defensive intensity and engagement has been really high, but you can just see they don't have the horses offensively. Well, that should theoretically be over. And once everyone's shaken the rust off and all of that, they should have the horses to be more dangerous offensively now. I'm curious, though, about the process, right? Because you think about how this season has unfolded for the Canucks. They came into training camp. They really wanted to be more dangerous off the rush, right? They established themselves as a great defensive team last year. They wanted to add a more dangerous offensive element to that. Got thrown off the rails by all of these absences and everything. Understandable. Now it feels like they've really rediscovered their defensive form from last season. But we're also in January. We don't have a training camp coming up. There's not a lot of practice time. All of that. You're more than halfway through the season. How difficult is it going to be for them to kind of get back into the mindset of, all right, now we got to find a way to be more dangerous offensively? It almost feels like they have to change their team identity midseason with 40 games to go left in the regular season.
See, I don't think it's change the mentality. I think it is finally getting to their
sure.
mentality. And I think that's a very big difference, though. Like, change to me is, okay, we're going to do something completely different. Now it's, okay, we've been talking about this for a long time and haven't really been able to put it into practice to even see if it works for us or not. And because, you know, let's be honest, like, it's a lot of what they were talking about relies on the D being able to move the puck up quickly and efficiently.
Yep.
And as soon as Hronek went out, coming into a season where they, before training camp even started, saying, we know we need another defenseman and we need someone that can move the puck a bit. And now all of a sudden at that point, they now need two guys that can move the puck and play some minutes with Hronek out. So, like, they haven't been able to really put it in. So I think it's more kind of unleashing the guys and saying, like, hey, like, we've been carrying around all this baggage and we've done a good job of not letting it affect us in the sense of, like, this could have been a lot worse
yes.
standing wise
yep.
than what just transpired. Like, you look at the pieces that were missing, like, there's not many teams that are getting through that and not only, like, are in the race, but even really in the hunt at mm-hmm. that point. Like, you can see how quick things go wrong in Nashville, right? Like, they mess up through the first part of the year with no injuries, really, and they're done. Like, they're too far gone. And so for Vancouver here, like, I think it's having that meeting and say, like, okay, like, we can cut that ties to all that baggage. And like, guys, everything that we were excited to play, is it going to work game one, shift one? Probably not. We're going to have some growing pains.
Yeah.
But like, this is the part where we can get excited together to grow and see where we can get to, because there is hope at the end of the tunnel now.
For you, looking at this team and, you know, as they try to find a way to be more dangerous, score more goals, generate more chances, all of that, is it off the rush for you? Is it what they're doing in zone? Is it just the simple, you know, possessing the puck more often than they have? Like, what's the key area that you look at and say, okay, that needs to improve and they can improve it to get to where they want to go offensively?
Shots.
Yeah.
I think it's literally that simple. Is like, they need to shoot the puck more. And I forget the stat off the top of my head from doing the game the other night in Toronto, but like, I want to say it's 8-0-1 when they get over 30 shots.
Right.
Like, the fact that that's not just up on the board every day saying, like, that is clear evidence of when we shoot the puck at volume, we win.
Mm-hmm.
So like, to me, I think it's obviously improving in your own end and getting that decor up to kind of snuff a bit more, and then just getting pucks to the net with bodies to the net. Like, it's so simple, yet every team, when they hit a bad stretch, it's usually the first thing is like, guys, we've stopped shooting. We're trying to find plays. Like, just get the puck to the net.
Yeah.
Just go back to simple.
Do you worry at all giving that message to the team about like low quality shots, but that you're just firing from everywhere?
But, I don't mean that. Like, I don't mean it.
Of course.
10 shots from the corner, or like, you know, if you're Connor Garland and you're going up the right side and you're basically 1-on-2.
Yeah.
Like, throwing it into Hellebuck's belly tonight, not really doing much.
Yeah.
So like, drive the puck down low, cut back up, try and find your play. But as soon as you see an opening with someone going towards the net, get it there.
Mm.
As soon as, especially from the defense, but like, as soon as they look up and they see a lane to the net with people there, put it on net. We don't have to see a shot tip in the high slot or the back door every single shot, because it looks great when it works and it's a great play, but when they try it 10 times a game and 9 of them end up rimming out of the far corner because their stick gets tied up, or like, it's a really tricky play to make. Like, that's not adding anything. Like, you're now trying, you go from a chance to get a puck on net with a chance of a rebound and maybe there's something there, to we have to get possession back. Like, we have to go win another board battle. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just making the game harder.
Yeah, I think you're 100% right about shots. Like, the stat, I think it was from before the Washington game, where they hadn't had 30 shots for like 15 games in a row or something. Because the other part of that stat is they're 8-0-1, but you've only done it 9 times this year. So your winning percentage is amazing. But man, it's been a struggle to get to that plateau. And I think another big part of that is just, as I was saying, you know, just to have the puck more, right? There's been how often, and we've all talked about it, the hot potato from the defenders, and to be fair, from the forwards as in their own zone, where it's just, I've got the puck and boom, it's out. And as much as people talk about what they can do in the offensive zone differently, and I think it's fair to say, you know, do they need to have some different options they can go to? It's absolutely fair, but the number one thing is they just need to, as you said, not constantly be chasing and expending all their energy trying to get the puck back. They got to keep it when they get it sometimes.
And I think just going back to the Toronto game, like, the difference there when they're playing with a lead, before, you know, earlier in this season and going back to last year, it was the same thing. Like, they're trying to protect a lead, and it was a high flip to the far blue line, mm-hmm. or just to the top of the other end circles. And really all that's doing is giving you time to go change and then really set up in a trap, essentially, because they've got the puck at the far end looking square up the ice and you're just getting out into position. Like, the Toronto game, they got into more soft chips. They were just getting to the far blue, but it's taking a bit of time to get there. So now they have someone going to pressure.
Right.
Like, they were getting on top of players. And when they were chipping the puck into the offensive zone, like, it wasn't a hard rim to the goalie. It wasn't a soft cross-corner dump where now you're chasing after one guy who, as you're chasing down to him, you're like, I know he's going to go D to D and they're going to get out the far side, but I'm going to have to chase it anyway. Like, there was more like soft into the corner with someone coming with speed. Like they were building off of each other, and that is a completely different way to go about it. And yeah, you're still chipping the puck away, but it's with a purpose and with like with a chance to get it back instead of just buying yourself 8 seconds to see what's happening.
I mean, they were a great forechecking team last year, right? That was a bread and butter thing for them, where it was they're sending the puck in deep. For as much as people complain about the dump and chase this year, again, it worked at a really high level for them last year. They have guys that can do it at a high level. It just hasn't been anywhere. And I think you're right. It all kind of stems from what they're doing, getting the puck out of the zone, and they're putting themselves in position where the forecheck can't be effective then. But it's not as if it's impossible for it to be a good strategy. We've seen it work for them.
No, you just, like, you need to be connected because, you know, just breaking it down this way. So I'm on the right wing. I soft chip down into the right corner. You're my centerman. You go get the puck. Well, we already know I'm not going to get through that defenseman. So now the far side winger is going to come across and be your support. Mm-hmm. And then I filter over top. But if I'm standing at the far blue line by myself and stretching it out and it's a tip into the corner, well, now you're coming from probably our blue line. Well, you're not getting down there.
Yep.
And now you're making the left winger have to read off of you. And he's like, well, I don't really know where to go either now. Like, when things are connected, you can play fast. You can get on top of the other team quicker. It doesn't give them an out. So when they go D to D, that second forechecker can already read that, and he can meet the player in the corner. Like, now you've created a puck battle. You have a chance to keep it in zone. Before, it's so spread out that as soon as you make one pass, you've broken the Canucks forecheck, and now you're out of the zone. So it's about getting back to that connectiveness and being able to play in the offensive zone and jump the next play. Like, you have to be able to read the next play, and that's by doing your forecheck right. It always forces into what you know is coming.
So looking at this matchup with the Jets tonight, I mean, the Jets have a bunch of guys that are playing really, really well. Obviously, you know, Josh Morrissey on the blue line, Kyle Connor, Scheifele, Gabe Vilardi's having a fantastic season up and down the lineup, but Connor Hellebuyck is a beast for them in net. Best goalie in the league right now. Clear Vezina frontrunner. Might get into the Hart Trophy conversation. Psychologically, when you're going up against not just an excellent goalie, but an excellent goalie who's on a heater like Hellebuyck, how do you approach it as a team? What do you need to do to just set yourself up, like, psychologically and in terms of your game plan to have success against a great goalie?
Like, I feel like I'm just not using my brain now because I'm almost just going to repeat what I said before in the sense
enough.
Of like, no, but like, you have a goalie that is stopping everything.
Yes.
Well, what do you do when he stops everything? You try and make it so he can't see
right.
what's coming. So you need to have one guy in front. You need to have another guy that's a little, you know, a couple feet off the net, and you have to get pucks into the blue. Like, you're not going to beat him clean from the half wall. You're not going to beat him clean from most places. So it's about getting pucks into the crease, making him either cough up rebounds or making something where, you know, you get the puck in there, he can't read it because he can't see it. Now it hits him in the right arm and it bounces back door and someone's there to bang it in. Like, you need to make it as hard as possible on him. And for any goalie, that's always take away their eyes as much as possible.
Yeah. Easier said than done, of
Way
course.
Easier.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, that is seems to be what it always comes down to for these top guys. Was there a goalie in your day where it was like every time he's on the other side, you're like, oh, no, not this guy again. Not this guy.
Honestly, for me, it was every time it was a righty catcher.
Oh, okay.
Like the flip hands.
Yeah.
Because I was always so jealous of every left-hander that got to take that low blocker shot. It just seemed like a cheat code. Like, it's so unfair.
Yeah.
And then I would see it down there, and I always loved shooting high glove, and now all of a sudden that knob's sitting there. You hit it once, and you're like, well, I'm never shooting there because that just hurts to see. And I'm like, well, now I'm going to put in that blocker spot. You'd never hit it. I could never do it. I was like, it threw me for a loop everywhere. I mean, for me, it was a high glove shot at all times.
Yeah, that's so
it was
funny.
Either going to look good or not go in.
That's funny, though. Like, just the guy switching it up was that could throw you for a loop like that. I mean, it's pretty rare, too, to see
it
the right catcher.
That's why it throws you off
exactly.
so much.
You're
but
like, what the
for
heck?
Some reason, the American League always had a lot more of them down there. That they're always, like, just good
That
enough
is interesting.
And, it, like, you'd hit them all the time, and you're like, God, not again.
So I think the other big story with the Jets beyond Hellebuck is, and you know, we'll talk about the top line here. I'm curious to see if they throw Pettersson back in that matchup role against Scheifele and Connor. But the depth of the team is really, really stands out. What they're able to roll out, the four lines, the defense pairings, all of that. Is it fair to look at this as a measuring stick game for the Canucks, considering, you know, technically they do have almost everyone back with the exception of Dakota Joshua? Or do we need to kind of allow that? Well, look, everyone's back, but, you know, Hronek's just coming back. But, you know, given those circumstances, do you still look at this as a game where we can really learn a lot about the Canucks and how they match up with a pretty deep team here?
Honestly, like, I think at this point, especially for the next five games, literally every game is a good measuring stick because they're each going to present a different obstacle you got to get through. Mm-hmm. And for this team right now, again, like, you're almost treating this as the start of the season, even though everything is so much more important. Like, it's, we're in the back half and it is what it is, but like, they're essentially starting the season with their full team for the first time. And it's, yes, it's going to take some time to see how it all goes, but there's definitely ways to watch and read and react and see how this team responds as they're moving through. Like today, or, you know, Toronto, they're not like the heaviest team.
Yeah.
There are skill and they speed. Like, we'll talk about third lines. So Toronto, their third line, Adomi, Robertson, and who am I blanking on there?
I don't know. I have to look it up.
Someone on the other side.
Yeah.
You know, like, that line was absolutely buzzing the other night. And
McMahon.
Yeah. And, like, so they move all over the place. They're playing with a ton of speed. Like, their third line of Niederreiter, who's a tank.
Mm-hmm.
And then Perfetti's obviously on the smaller side, but has skill. Like, they play a different game. And it's about getting through the toughness and the size of Winnipeg, which is going to give another obstacle here. Like, it's different in that sense, but like, you have to be able to line up your bottom six like that, you know, like Suter and Sherwood, like, they're going to have to be able to handle some big boys. And mm-hmm. the fact that they can skate and hopefully try and not let Winnipeg set up into where they're rolling in the offensive zone using their, you know, their big size, that, you know, will just kind of take energy away from the Canucks. It's about trying to roll through them as quick as you can.
Yeah, I do feel like the Canucks match up pretty decently against bigger teams. It's oftentimes the fast teams that can really give
them
problems.
They want to open it up. Yeah,
but you look at, I mean, especially on the blue line for the Canucks, like, okay, big physical team, like, that should theoretically be a, I don't want to say it was an easy match. Obviously, the Jets are a really good team, but I think just that style of opposition sets up better for the Canucks than some of the really fast, skilled teams. Like, I just think about when New Jersey came through, and it was like, oh my goodness.
Like, they want to track meet, and that's not a great look.
No.
But no, like, I do agree. Like, this is a team, going back to what we were just talking about, of getting the puck in, like, it's getting it behind their D, like, just behind, making them turn, finding vulnerabilities that way. Like, it's, you know, it's a deep team. You need the Canucks, the whole lineup, to show up, and you need them to be ready to play like a heavy man's mm-hmm. game today. Like, it's not going to be a game where you can be playing at the end of your stick and a little bit of poke and hope. And, like, you know, you're at your blue line. Well, if I poke it by this guy, I might have a breakaway or a 2-on-1. Like, this is probably the night, just like it was in Toronto, where you stop on the D side and make sure you get that puck out. Yeah, you might not get your offensive chance, but you know that you've made the right defensive play and you live to fight the next shift. Like, you're going to have to be responsible and mature enough to make those decisions tonight.
Now, you're talking about playing that big physical style of game, and one player who jumps to mind for me immediately is JT Miller. And, you know, only a few minutes left in the show here, but we've talked a lot this year, today, specifically about Elias Pettersson, what he needs to do to really be the best version of himself. You know, I think JT Miller, it's fair to have that conversation about him as well. Has that 4-point game in Montreal, but the shift-to-shift impact after that in the road trip, you know, the minutes have been down a little bit from where we're used to seeing them for JT Miller. What are you seeing from him right now? And is there, you know, with Pettersson, we talked about just move his legs more, all those things. Like, is there a simple fix you want to see in JT Miller's, or a simple element maybe that you want to see in JT Miller's game right now?
I mean, for him, it's, I mean, his whole game comes down to putting his nose in everywhere on the ice. Like, he plays emotional and he plays hard. Like, you can tell the guy cares. And he needs to be in the fight, in the battle, every shift. The hard thing is, you know, like, watching, it's, there's still, you know, it almost seems like once a game he takes a bump or throws a bump that he ends up kind of having that wince after again. Like, there just still seems like there's something that's just like he's working his way through. And it's so hard to judge and say, like, you know, because for him, yeah, like, he is a big power forward that when he's on top of his game, like, you don't want to be the guy going against him because he doesn't care if he goes around you. Like, he will skate through you and he will make you feel it. And that's why people love watching him play at the top of his game. But without knowing that he is fully healthy and he can really, what his limitations are, like, it's hard to say he needs to throw himself in there, because it's every time he does, like, you can see the effort is trying to be made and that it just, it reels him back a little bit.
Yeah, it's a good point about just the playing through things. And that's why, as much as I'm so curious about, all right, hey, they've got the horses back, everyone's healthy, let's see what this team looks like, I'm also mindful that, you know, just because guys are on the ice doesn't mean they're necessarily 100%. You know, hey, you're available, you have to perform, but there are guys working through things and it might still be a couple of weeks process here for the team to, you know, fully ramp up and see the best version of themselves.
Yeah, and again, like, I'm saying this right now, it's not like I have JT Miller's text line open to me and he's like, hey man, like,
I'm
working through something. But it's just, you know, my observations watching, like, I feel like there's still at least once a game where you see him where his shoulders kind of shrug back up and you can see it's something up top that, like, it might just easily be like, you know, a little stinger that just flares up. But man, like, that's a lot to get through when your whole job is moving off reaction. Like, I don't know about you, but, like, man, I threw my back out about 2.5 days ago playing with my one-year-old on the floor. Wasn't doing a whole lot. I just tried to move.
Yeah.
But, like, now it's like we all notice it. Like, you go to get out of the car and, like, you feel it kind of hit. Mm-hmm. Like, now think of someone trying to hit you while trying to do that. Like, yes. It's a lot going into it, man.
Yeah. It's you're at that age, huh? Where it's just like basic movements. And you're like, oh, wow, that doesn't feel right.
Well, it also doesn't help that I've worked out 3 times since I retired 2 years ago. I haven't quite found my way back to the gym.
You're on that once every 8 month workout plan.
Yeah. And it's like, I'm always, I go back in with like a huge promise of like, yeah, I'm doing it.
This is it.
And then my legs get sore trying to go up the stairs the next day. I'm like, yeah, I can wait a few months again.
But I just think, on just to wrap it up on JT Miller, I mean, you look at the time on ice is the tell for me, right? Like, we know Rick Tocchet loves to play JT Miller when he's going 13 minutes, such a hair over 13 minutes against Toronto. Like, that kind of tells you everything you need to know. You would think about his health status and where he's at physically right now. Landon, awesome as always, man. Appreciate the insight. Appreciate you taking some time to chat with me and hang out here in studio. It's the Canucks and the Jets tonight. Batch and Randeep have the call here on the station. Josh Elliott-Wolf has the People's Show coming up next here on Sportsnet 650.